An upcoming BOW forum explores the question, what has America learned? From SDPB, today is Monday, March 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome an Augustana University historian to discuss the arrival of author John Meacham on campus this week. It's a lecture designed to explore where we've been as a nation, which opens the door to where we might go in the days ahead. Now, before we get to that, we will revisit a conversation about America's first ladies with historian Diana Carlin. That's coming up after the news. And later in the hour, Rick Kaler travels the world, but he doesn't leave his financial therapy curiosity behind. We'll talk about what he learned in Jordan that might resonate particularly for women here at home. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The most enduring White House legacies are not always those of the men who served the nation as president. Presidential spouses, first ladies, if you will, serve as hostess and domestic diplomat, fashion icon, and White House steward. Their initiatives have changed our lives, especially the lives of women and girls in America. Diana B. Carlin is Professor Emerita of Communications at St. Louis University and a retired Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Kansas. She co-authored the book Remember the Ladies, The Legacies of America's History-Making Women. All right, let's talk about this book, because this is a new look at First Ladies, in as much as it is not a series of biographies of famous women. It is looking at the office and the way these women have changed it over time. So can we start with the idea that, you know, this is not an elected office? There's no constitutional, you know, precedent for what the behavior or the office is supposed to be. Are women just making this up as they go? Take us back in time, please.
Well, they all approach it their own way. Martha Washington was the one who definitely had to make it up as she was going along. And Abigail Adams and Dolly Madison did a little bit of the same. But much of what they put in place is still being done. For instance, the hostess role is still a very important part. And there's a lot of what we call soft diplomacy going along with that. But they all are affected by their backgrounds, by their own interests. Their marriage has a lot to do with what they're able to do. The first ladies who've had really solid relationships with husbands who wanted to support them often give them a lot of free rein, where others, for instance, Calvin Coolidge, thought it was great for Grace to do very traditional hostess things, which he didn't want her to do anything new. So there are a lot of different factors that affect it. But I think the point you made at the beginning, that this isn't an elective office, it isn't a constitutionally charged office. It's one that has grown out of the fact that our president is both the head of government and the head of state. So in a lot of other countries, you have a monarch who's the head of state, or you have, you know, like a president who's head of state, prime minister who's head of government. So those roles of, you know, pardoning turkeys and hosting delegations and state dinners goes to the head of state, but our president has to do both. And the Washingtons realized he needed help. So that was where Martha came in. But because it isn't a requirement, many first ladies have decided to do very little, and they have that choice. So there really is a lot of latitude in how they approach it.
Were there significant gaps in scholarship that you found where the research was waiting to be discovered, but there hadn't been a book like yours previously?
Yeah, the scholarship has been, as you said earlier, a lot of biographical collections. That was where it started, and that was important because these women were virtually unknown, especially many of the 19th century women. And then there have been a lot of individual biographies. There have been books that have looked at, for instance, the modern First Lady, and especially there's a new one by Katie Rogers in the New York Times, just looking from Hillary Clinton on. others that have looked at, for instance, there's one on Southern First Ladies and the influence of the South on the position. And because so many of our first First Ladies, except for Abigail Adams, were Southerners, that did have a large influence, especially on entertaining and this kind of soft diplomacy. So those were, you know, some of the things that I think really were happening. And what we wanted was a book that looked at the position itself and all of the factors that have affected that position, the one I just mentioned. And also, the role of women in society has changed. So as that role has changed, women have taken on new responsibilities as First Lady. So, for instance, when we had the 19th Amendment in 1920 and women were voting, you began to see them getting a little more active in campaigns, to the point where now, you know, the spouse has a full schedule, independent schedule. But that didn't really come into play until 1964 with Lady Bird. So a lot of evolution, and that's what we wanted to look at, was the historical factors and the themes that these women have addressed over time. And when you do a bunch of individual biographies, you can't all, and many of them were edited with many authors, a different author for every biography. You can't pull those threads together. Yeah. So, for example, Martha Washington was very dedicated to veterans and to widows. And we have, you know, Jill Biden and Michelle Obama, you know, joining forces. Mm-hmm. They're still looking at military families. So that's been a thread that's connected the first First Lady with the current First Lady, and we've had First Ladies all along the way who have supported veterans. So those are the kinds of things that we wanted to pull through the book that no one else had done. And I think that's a piece of the scholarship that was missing, was really how you link all of this context together with the women who've held the position.
The incoming First Lady, does she have a sense of that history? Does Dr. Jill Biden know that Martha Washington cared about these things? Is there a way for her to learn that? Or is that all on her to sort of, you know, follow her interest in learning about the role?
Well, it's a little bit of both. For several years now, there has been a book prepared for the First Lady. I don't know if they've done it every election cycle, but it's sort of a report to the incoming First Lady that has some of this history in it. It tends to be a little more, you know, biographical, but it looks at the role of the press. And so that book's hard to get a hold of. One of my co-authors, Nancy Keegan Smith, has a copy of it. And so we did, you know, look at that. So there is an attempt to really bring that history to them. And many of them have done a lot of that research on their own. But at the same time, they want to do the things that really stir their souls, mm-hmm. and that they're passionate about. So they have the sense of history because they do get some briefings, but they also pave their own way.
How important is stewardship of the White House in the role of First Lady?
The stewardship of the White House is extremely important. In fact, our book dedicates an entire chapter to that, where we look at the role of the First Ladies with the White House. The Adams were the first to live there, and they were only there for a few months because John didn't move in until December of 1800, and then he went out of office in March, and it was really not even complete. And then after the War of 1812, it had to be rebuilt, and the Monroes, Elizabeth Monroe, had a lot to do with that. But the real stewardship came with Jackie Kennedy. She had gone through the White House as a child, and there wasn't even a brochure, and she thought it was kind of tattered, and it was, because Congress never appropriated enough money, and that's why it was falling apart by the time the Trumans got there. And they had to move out, and they had to basically take it down to the walls. And there's a picture in our book that shows that. So Jackie Kennedy realized there'd never be enough government money, so she established the White House Historical Association, which is over 60 years old now. And so much of what's done to preserve the White House is done through private funding, through the White House Historical Association. And other First Ladies have taken that seriously. Lady Bird continued with some of her work, and Pat Nixon completed a lot of what Jackie Kennedy wanted to do, bringing in original artifacts, not necessarily original to the White House itself, but to the time periods that they were wanting to reflect in each of the rooms. You will still see, you know, renovations being done. Laura Bush renovated the Lincoln bedroom, for example, and Melania Trump did several things inside, but also with the gardens. So they all take that role very seriously.
How much private political influence do these women have, do these spouses have?
Much, especially the more recent first ladies. As I said, they actually have from the beginning. Yeah. You know, Martha burned all of the letters between the two of them, but of course she was with him all of the time. But in some of her letters to family, she had some opinions about our relations with England, and I'm sure she expressed those to George, but she stayed out of the political fray. But we had some very powerful early first ladies, such as Abigail Adams, who was very influential in appointments and in pushing him to sign the Alien and Sedition Act, which ended up being his downfall. Sarah Polk, who no one knows anything about, was one of the most powerful first ladies we had. She wrote his speeches. She was a gatekeeper. Of course, we had Edith Wilson, who was doing quite a bit as almost an acting president during his stroke rehabilitation. And then Nancy Reagan, you know, Lady Bird, was very influential. I believe Dr. Biden, you know, she gave us an interview for the book, and she was just saying that she wasn't an advisor, but she was a spouse, and they talked about their work, her work and his, and in that way, she could bring ideas to him that she was picking up from students and from people she knew. And like I said, Nancy Reagan certainly had a lot of influence, including helping to get the Cold War ended. So many of these women have had a tremendous amount of influence on their husbands through the private conversations.
Yeah. And does that cause a pain point for advisors who aren't in the bedroom at night, essentially?
Well, it can. And there have certainly been tensions between the East Wing and the West Wing more than once. And, you know, most first ladies who are savvy realize that anything they want to do, they have to have the support of the West Wing to do it. One of my other co-authors, Anita McBride, was Laura Bush's chief of staff. And Mrs. Bush brought her on during the second term, and Anita had been at the State Department, and Mrs. Bush wanted to go to Afghanistan because she was very concerned about Afghan women and girls. And when she talked to Anita about the position, she told her what she wanted to do. And Anita said the first question she asked her was, is the West Wing supportive? And she said yes. And Anita always makes that point that a successful first lady, you know, works with the West Wing, that they're all on the same page. And as I said, when they haven't been, there can be some tensions.
You've been talking about these women, but certainly in the future of America, there should be a first gentleman at some point. So that brings the opportunity to talk about the first ladies who have set precedent and the ways that that changes the role and the ways that matters to the country when somebody new, whether it's Jill Biden with her job outside of the White House, or it's Michelle Obama as the first Black first lady. What's the role of and the impact of precedent-setting first ladies or first spouses?
Well, precedence is important, but the thing we talk about in the book is that these women have been mirrors of society at the time, so following precedents have followed in the footsteps of their predecessors, but they've also been change agents. And when we have a first gentleman, and, you know, at some point we're going to have one, we came close, you know, in 2016. We have a possibility this time. It may or may not happen. And if it doesn't, it's certainly going to happen at some point, because there are more and more women governors, more women, 25 in the Senate. So more and more women are in the pipeline. And I think the precedents will impact a first gentleman. And if we look at the way Doug Emhoff has been the second gentleman, it's been very traditional. When asked what his most important responsibility is, he said to support his wife. And that's really what most first ladies will tell you, that everything they do is to support their husband, his administration, his policies, in the best way they can. And I believe that is really the direction a first gentleman will go. I fully expect a first gentleman to continue to work, and that's where I think Dr. Biden opened that door in some ways for a first gentleman. So we can envision now the president's spouse being working outside the White House, mm-hmm. and that had certainly not been done before. So she did set that new precedent of being able to work outside. And issues, you know, they're going to have issues, too, that they care about. So I don't think we're going to see a dramatic change in the approach to being a supportive spouse to the president.
Are there first ladies who have been more effective than perhaps their husbands at creating a legacy that we recognize today?
Oh, I think definitely there have been some. You know, if you look at Betty Ford, for example, she was first lady for less than 3 years, and what she accomplished was nothing short of amazing, especially given her health issues. What she did with bringing breast cancer and the need for early detection into the open, at the time in 1974 when she was diagnosed, we wouldn't have been able to say the word breast or cancer in this interview. You did not say the word breast in the news, and no one used the word cancer when they would be reporting someone's illness. So she said it was time to bring it out into the open because she was going about her business, and all of a sudden she's in the hospital with a mastectomy, and she knows there are other women who have undetected. And so she saved lives, and she continued to do that after First Lady. Then her addiction to prescription drugs and alcohol, she came out in the open, and the Hazelden Betty Ford Center has helped thousands of people. I mean, that's just an enduring legacy. If you look at Barbara Bush and her literacy foundation, she started doing that when she was second lady and then really pushed it as first lady and started her foundation. They've given over $100 million in literacy programming support, and there will probably be more, you know, in the future. So, you know, those are just a couple examples. What Michelle Obama is doing with women worldwide and girls' issues is an incredible legacy. So we have Jackie Kennedy, White House Historical Association, 63 years. So these first ladies are able to have these lasting legacies, largely because the issues they take on are not overtly political. They aren't as policy-oriented, and we saw when a first lady tries to get into policy, as Hillary Clinton did with health care, huge pushback, and that's just really not a direction that they can or should go. So the kinds of issues they take on are bigger societal issues that go beyond partisan politics, and I believe that's why they're able to have this lasting impact that is very well-known. Rosalynn Carter, another example with what she did with mental health and caregivers. Mm-hmm. So these women in some ways outshine their husbands post-presidency. Eleanor Roosevelt with the UN and the Declaration of Human Rights. So it's really pretty amazing when you stop and look at it.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
What they have done.
It's astonishing when you string them together. Yeah,
and there are more. You know, I could keep going. And that's another point we make in the book. Is when you put all those together in a single chapter, it's pretty profound, the impact that they've had.
That is quite a string of pearls.
Yes, I like that.
All right, what if they debated? Hypothetically, if there was a first lady debate, what would you advise?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Well, they kind of debate with recipes. We've had cookie bake-offs a couple times. Yeah, interesting that you should say that because, as you mentioned, one of my other areas of research is political debates, presidential debates. And there was a debate between Eleanor Roosevelt, who was no longer a first lady at the time, and Margaret Chase Smith representing Eisenhower and Stevenson on Face the Nation. Huh. And you can find it online. And so we did have a former first lady debating. I think if that no one has asked this is an interesting question. I think if they debated, I would want the questions to really center on the role and, you know, what they think they needed to do to support their husbands and what they think as a first lady they can do in a nonpartisan way. Because that's one thing the first ladies all say is, you know, they've been called like the comforter in chief after tragedies like 9/11. And Lou Henry Hoover was going on the radio to try to help women get through the Depression. And that's nonpartisan. So I'd like to hear them talk about the importance of the nonpartisanship of the First Lady and then talk about what their legacy, you know, what they want it to be. So those would be a couple of the things, how they believe the First Lady should support her husband and what they think the limits of the position are. Those would be some of the questions I'd want them to answer.
Any other thoughts that you want to leave us with today?
I think, you know, the part of the reason we wrote the book, I taught a course for over 30 years, and students knew nothing about first ladies, and they kept saying, why didn't we learn this in history? As we have been going around the country talking about the book, people say, why didn't I learn this? And that's why we wrote the book. This started out as a textbook, and our editor said, why didn't I learn this? Would you be willing to do a different version for the public? Because this is an incredible important part of our history, and I don't think you can understand the presidency completely without understanding the role of the spouse. And if we want this inclusive history, then I think you have to include these women in it.
That's Diana Carlin, co-author of the book, Remember the Ladies, The Legacy of America's History-Making Women. After the break, let's move on to the presidents. We'll talk with Augustana Professor Michael Mullins ahead of the 28th Annual Beau Forum that features presidential historian John Meacham. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The 28th Annual Beau Forum on Public Affairs takes place this week. It will feature an evening with John Meacham, presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His talk, entitled What Has America Learned, is scheduled for 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 19th. That's in the Ellman Center on the campus of Augustana University. We'll talk now with Michael Mullins, professor of history at Augie. He joined me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to preview the event and to address the question, What Has America Learned?
The Beau Forum is an endowed speakership where we bring in a person who is out of the news per se, that is, they can't be an active politician, but someone who has expertise on a topic or an issue that confronts the nation at the present time. It was set up by a former governor, Nels Boe, and it is designed to be free to the public, and it is designed to engage the public in questions of the day. And these can range from when George Bush the Elder came, right, to talk about his experience as president, or when Desmond Tutu came, the end of apartheid in South Africa. We've had them on healthcare. We've had them on the change of technology. The subject is wide open. And this year, the Center for Western Studies decided to invite a historian to provide some background on America and the presidency and to set the stage for a project that's coming next year, America for 250, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
Who is John Meacham?
So John Meacham is a well-established scholar at Vanderbilt University, and he runs a Center for Unity and Democracy. And he is one of the few historians, I think, that tries to engage the public in an academic discourse. That is, he's not writing to other historians per se. He's writing to make presidents understandable to the general public so that they can make their own decisions about what they're seeing.
All right. So this is an important choice. Are you on the committee that helps choose?
I was not on the committee.
On this one, you were not.
I'm on the Center for Western Studies board, but there is a subcommittee that makes that recommendation to the larger board. So they...
So what happens with students then? Because it's about, you know, I'm going to be in attendance and in the audience and listening. And there's always students that get up and ask questions that are, you know, facilitated by one of the Augustana professors. So take us into the onto campus and tell me a little bit about what Beau Forum looks like on campus.
So Beau Forum on campus, generally, it depends on flights and you can imagine weather. Right. But we asked the candidate to come in, the speaker to come in a day before, the evening before, and they then spend the day working with both Augustana students and local high school students. Oh, so there is generally a forum. So the local high school, the journalism programs come and they get to ask questions. It's closed to the public. It's closed to faculty. It is just a student and speaker event. Mm-hmm. The Augustana student, journalism students will get a chance to meet. And so that takes place in the afternoon. And then in preparation for that, whoever the speaker is, depending on the speaker, a department is asked to pick two students to ask questions from. So this year, the history department was asked to nominate two students.
Okay.
And the students work with a faculty member to come up with a list of questions that they will ask the presenter. This year, Ian Kelly and Lily Roberts will be the two students. They have been reading John Meacham. They've been listening to some of his interviews on Meet the Press and other, and they've come up with a set of questions, more questions than they'll have time to ask, but that's the origins of the student participation.
Yeah, I love that part of the Beau Forum as someone who asks questions to sit back and listen to the powerful questions that some of these students come up with. And you go, wow, that was so well thought out. And they have follow-up questions too. I mean, they're not just reading from a card.
They do, and We're hoping he's going to answer one of the questions, which we see as a softball question.
Uh-huh.
But John Meacham wrote a book with Tim McGraw on music and politics. And it goes from the American Revolution to the present. So if you remember, well, you're too young, but Ronald Reagan wanted to use Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA on a campaign, and Bruce Springsteen said no.
Right.
And so it looks at the debates there, or at the role of the battle hymn of the Republic during the Civil War. And so it looks at how music and politics have interacted over the course of American history.
I am not too young for Ronald Reagan. In fact, I played in the Lincoln High Marching Band when Reagan came to Sioux Falls, and I had a baritone solo, I'm just saying. So yes, I'm aware. I want to talk about this question, what has America learned, and a little bit about how you come at this question. I'm looking forward to hearing, obviously, what John Meacham has to say. But when you think of the topic, as someone in the history department, what does that bring up for you with your students?
Well, I think for a historian, the question is, have we seen this before?
Mm.
And what was the result of this before? And so I have been reading his book on Andrew Jackson.
Okay. Have we seen this before as in a presidency like this?
Yes.
Because we're talking about presidential politics.
Yeah, we're talking about a presidential
story. What in this administration have we seen before?
Is there something similar to this? And so and Meacham in an interview said that probably Andrew Jackson was the one president most like President Donald Trump. It is not, the talk is not meant to be about Donald Trump, but about the presidency and the history of the presidency and how it evolves over time.
Okay.
So,
but gosh, that's interesting right now because we look at how this president is using power. And that is bringing up big questions about the role of Congress, the role of the judiciary. You can say it's not about President Trump, but this president is unafraid to come at the presidency in a brand new way.
Right, and that was Andrew Jackson, going back to what two historians look. Andrew Jackson was the first president to really see himself as the head of a party, a political party.
Okay.
He was the first, he was also something of a populist, we'd use that phrase today. He would argue that he was the only person that all Americans had voted for, unlike a congressperson, unlike a senator, right? So the only elected official is the president, and therefore that gives the president a weight and a power that other politicians shouldn't have. Unfortunately, it was Andrew Jackson who appointed Roger Taney to the Supreme Court, and Taney is the Chief Justice during the Dred Scott decision.
Okay.
So you can draw all types of parallels to the present if you'd like.
Right, yes.
We do not, we, the Center for Western Studies, I don't mean to be an imperial we, but the topic is up to the speaker. We do not say, will you talk about X or will you talk about Y? We assume that they'll talk about certain things, but we do not have a, will you talk on X for us? We say, we'd like you to come in. You have this expertise. You have this experience. Would you be willing to give a presentation to the South Dakota citizens and Minnesota, Iowa, local as well, on your expertise.
Yeah. What kinds of conversations are you having with your students now about this presidency? I don't know what you're teaching this semester. That's always such a question that depends on what you're teaching and when it comes up. But what would you add to that's fitting into right now to where you're at in class?
So interestingly enough, I'm teaching two courses which seem to have nothing to do with it, but have everything to do with it. I'm teaching a Western civilization to 1648. And while it doesn't seem that the Roman Empire would have anything to do with today, trade wars and declining trade, and what did that mean, and what happened in Rome when the empire began to collapse, and how did the economy shrink? Trying to pick readings that maybe raise questions about power, questions about who's responsible for what, changes in ideology. Mm-hmm. And I teach a course for our first year seminar. We have a number of students that came in the spring semester as opposed to fall for a variety of reasons. And it's on 1968, and that course actually tries to use 1968 to show how today's issues have their origins, you know, 60 years before.
Yeah, that's everything.
Yeah.
I mean, every time I turn around, it's like 50 years, and there's something that we're talking about that happened during that pretty small window of time. Give me an example that's interesting to listeners, you think.
Well, LGBTQ issues would be one, right? We haven't had Stonewall yet. Women could not own a credit card in their own name yet if they were married. And so these questions about who gets to participate, what do we do with the marginalized, economic inequality, all of those issues of 1968 have parallels to today, as well as what does it mean to be a conservative?
Sure. Yeah. All right. Final thoughts about Beauforum. Is it already sold out?
It is not. You can go to...
Those tickets are free.
They're free. Yeah. And you can get more than one, so you can bring a friend. I think you can get up two or four. And it is Wednesday the 19th, and we would love to have people show up, and we think it will be informative.
Yeah. I enjoy it every year. I think the first one I went to was Colin Powell, the former general, and then we saw Gorbachev. You know, in Sioux Falls back in the day, in the early days of the Beauforum. And I remember just looking around at the time going, am I sitting in Sioux Falls, you know, hearing Mikhail Gorbachev speak? And that was, I think, when a lot of people in Sioux Falls were getting their mind around the fact that this could happen here, that the Beauforum brought this level of speaker and of discourse to us here in the middle.
And I think it speaks well to Sioux Falls, not just the university, right? Sioux Falls is a change community, and we are in many ways at the center of what is happening. And so the fact that Sioux Falls can host this, not just the university, speaks very well for the community.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today about it.
My pleasure.
That's Michael Mullins, professor of history at Augustana University. The Beauforum on Public Affairs is Wednesday, March 19th. That's in the Ellman Center of the Augustana University campus. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, more exchange of international ideas. We've got financial advisor and financial therapist Rick Kaler with us. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's pivot now to an international exchange of economic ideas, one that hit home for Rick Kaler. Finances are always on his mind, even when traveling around the world. Well, during a recent trip to Jordan, he steered small talk with a local family toward estate planning. What he learned surprised him, until it didn't. Kaler is a wealth advisor and financial therapist in the Black Hills. He's founder of the Kaler Financial Group. We connected with him from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
It is very insightful to get input from different cultures and different thoughts, especially around money, because money can be very cultural. Money scripts can be very cultural. So while visiting Jordan 6 weeks ago, a couple months ago, I had the opportunity to go to have a meal in the house of a local citizen. And it was really insightful. The meal was wonderful, and the talk ranged on a number of things. But as you can imagine, I think, Lori, you could imagine this, that I turned the discussion to money.
Yes, artfully, I suspect, yes.
And we got on the topic of estate planning. And I was curious how that works. And he was very, very measured in his answer. It was really quite straightforward. He said, well, you know, it's all kind of set out under our law. A wife will inherit 1/8 of the husband's estate, and 7/8 goes to the kids, and the males get 2-for-1. So whatever they get, the 50% goes to the daughters. And I don't know what we talked about for the next 5 or 10 minutes, because my mind was like 1/8. Yeah. And obviously, she didn't have much of anything to pass on. I think she had her her dowry, and I don't completely understand how that works, but it's not a whole lot. Yeah. And I managed to get the conversation back to, okay, tell me about this 1/8. And I asked her, you know, turning to her, how can you make it on 1/8? And she was just, she just smiled, and you know, there wasn't any concern at all. And she says, well, you know, my kids will take care of me. And then she chuckled and said, yeah, you know, it's kind of important for women to take care of their husbands, as she looked at him, because you don't want them to die and you don't want them to divorce you.
And so all my manuscripts are just firing right now, right?
As I imagine they might be.
Yeah. And that goes into that, again, travel. Yeah. Like, you have to pause and you have to say, well, wait a minute, what's happening here? Because they're telling themselves a very different story than what I'm telling myself. And one of the first things you see in the column is, okay, it's a lot more complicated than that. The inheritance law and what happens to widows in Islamic law is complex. It can't just be summed up in a, you know, 20-second, my kids will take care of me. However, we'll get back to that, my kids will take care of me in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's complicated, right? I mean, that, I'm reading that correctly.
It is. There are several things that they have. There's part of the support that comes from their dowry. There's some government support while they're grieving. And there is a very strong understanding that the sons will take care of the mother.
All right. But one of the things that you took away from this conversation was that this is about more than money. It's always about more than numbers. And we are all interconnected relationally. Which I love that takeaway.
Definitely. Definitely have that culture, which many, many cultures around the world have this interrelatedness, and especially the family system. My wife used to be married to a gentleman from Greece. And you can see this if you travel. You'll see one story or two stories of a house, and you'll see pillars sticking above the roof with rebar running through the pillars. Okay. And it looks like every house is unfinished. Uh-huh. And I asked about that, and my wife said, well, that's because they anticipate adding another story as the family expands.
Oh, huh.
So they just keep going up, and the whole family lives together. And that's common in many, many countries, that it's understood that the kids and the grandkids are going to take care of the village elders, a term I recently was called.
How'd that feel?
I'm like, what? So it's it is very common.
And that brings me to what is our system? You know, like, it seems like we have many systems. We have all kinds of things that one has to figure out, and we bring all kinds of different money scripts depending on our family. And certainly anybody who's been divorced or has had a money fight in a marriage, especially if the income was unequal, People bring different ideas about who earned what and therefore who has authority over what. And if there's a divorce, who gets to take what? These are things that people fight about, litigate about. What's going on there? Yeah, you've seen a lot of that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's huge in our culture, and we've worked very hard to obtain gender equality.
Yeah.
And we're not 100% there, but we are a lot further than, say, an Islamic country or a country where, like India, women are really fighting for their rights and are far from being held equal to males. So I would say we're nationally, we're one of the nations that have made a tremendous amount of progress with this, as probably Europe has as well. Mm. So with that comes a lot of complexity. I mean, in Jordan, it's pretty cut and dried. This is what happens. Here, it can get pretty ugly because it's not necessarily cut and dried. It's all down to the state level, to the local, what's normal in a local area as far as how the division of income and assets is handled. But the gold standard is as equally as possible.
Yeah. So you mentioned in this column, and I'm at KaylorFinancial.com for people who want to find all kinds of your writing. Certainly they can also go to SDPB.org and put your name in our search engine, and you'll find all our conversations coming up. A whole lot of, by the way, we have built over the years, a lot of free financial therapy for you to dive into. I'm happy when I look back and see that. It feels really good. But you're in Egypt, and you have another conversation about girls and education. Tell me about
this
that.
Was,
yeah, that's fascinating.
This was really insightful.
Yeah.
So I'm having dinner again with a local businessman there. And he starts talking about his family. And I believe he had two daughters and a son. And he himself had been divorced. And he and his wife still shared the same house. And he was talking about his daughters. And he says, well, My daughters are all studying abroad. One's going to become an attorney. One's going to become a medical doctor. And he said, you know, this is really important that a girl can take care of herself. Now, going to the conversation in Jordan where the lady says, yeah, it's really important to take care of your husband because if they die or you divorced, this can be, in so many words, traumatic, right?
Yeah.
Financially.
Yeah.
And this is the protection that the younger generation is taking on, is educate your daughters. Make sure that your daughters have a lucrative career, have really good skills. And then he says, you know, now my son, he'll be fine. He doesn't need to go to college. He can be a garbage collector, and I mean no disrespect to that. And he'll be fine because our society takes care of males. But my daughters, they had better be an attorney or a doctor, have fungible skills that can be used all over the world to be sure that they can survive.
So what are we to do? That's the hard thing when you come back from travel. You're processing your pictures, you're processing your stories, you're reflecting on what you've learned. So here we are. We live in South Dakota. We live in America. And especially for women who are listening, you're navigating some complex systems from Social Security. And if you do stay home, you don't necessarily get the Social Security. You know, if you under-earn because your husband was earning and you were doing some unpaid labor in the American labor force, you're not going to get compensated for that when you retire. But he is. And by then, you might be divorced or it might not be enough for both of you. So what are some of the ways that women in America need to consider their own safety nets, especially with this idea of interconnectivity that I think is That makes me feel happy. Part of this conversation makes me feel terrified, and then part of it makes me feel happy. So
yes,
all my, like I said, all the money scripts are showing up at the same time and clashing.
Well, we don't have the interconnectivity of many nations. We've worked really hard not to be connected.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that trend necessarily changes quickly.
Or not, I mean, to be beholden. We're also not beholden to each other in that way.
Exactly.
You can leave your family and go do something that you want to do.
Yeah.
You don't have to live in the same house forever. That's not necessarily a bad thing in America.
There's two sides of it. Well, the average person here thinking of your whole family living in one house.
No thanks.
yeah. So there are advantages, and there's reasons why we've moved this way. I think especially for women and women today, the advice of my friend in Egypt is probably pretty good, and that's having skills that can be monetized in the marketplace. And that's a big discussion for a couple to have when one is going to stay home and take care of the kids, which is a huge job that requires a lot of skills in itself. And the longer they do that, the less marketable they become in the marketplace.
Right.
So it's a big discussion, but I think it's really important for a person in the U.S. to be able to take care of themselves. And more important than, say, back to your example of somebody in the Scandinavian countries that have this huge social safety net, where that they can get a lot more support, government support, if they are singled or widowed, than in the U.S.
So we need to circle back to considering the reality of our own lives and some of the things that we believe about, you know, family and marriage and interconnectivity, have those conversations, deal with the anxiety of being a female in America or the anxiety of being a male in America or the anxiety of having parents and not knowing how you're going to take care of them, all the whatever you're feeling, feel those feelings and then keep going forward to make those plans.
Yeah, if you don't have anxiety, there's a lot of places where you can go get some.
I've got some extra. You can pick it up at my desk.
I suppose that's really not wise for a financial therapist to say, is it?
What I do love, though, is in the column that you wrote about Jordan, is just that awareness that even though sometimes it seems like we're on our own, that we do, if we think pretty hard about it, have an awful lot of family, neighbors, communities, you know, your neighborhood financial therapist. There's a lot of resources and interconnectivity that we have, and that makes us a lot more resilient than maybe we think we are.
And I think it underscores the benefit and almost the necessity of creating a community or joining a community and having those resources. And especially as I've watched my parents age and negotiate the medical systems and the assisted living systems, it is hard and I would say almost impossible to negotiate that alone.
Yeah,
a person has got to have somewhere an advocate for them.
Yeah.
And if you don't have family or family that's engaged, that's really expensive.
Well said. All right. We'll leave it there for today. I look forward very much to our next conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori. Always a pleasure.
That's Rick Kaler, a financial therapist and founder of the Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow is National Ag Day, so we are going to bring you some stories about agriculture in South Dakota. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.